Hi, everyone, and welcome back to our business mentoring podcast, the space where business isn't just about numbers, but about vision, resilience, and growth. I'm Diana Maria Georgescu, your host for today's insightful conversation. In this episode, we dive into the dynamic world of startups, exploring what it truly takes to bring bold ideas from Central and Eastern Europe onto the global stage. The primary objective of the conversation is to learn valuable lessons and from an international business consultant and apply them to the Romanian business context. In today's episode, I'm joined by Florin Crăciun, a sales and business development consultant with a sharp focus on the tech startup ecosystem. For the last decade, Florin has specialized in taking startups from Central and Eastern Europe onto the global stage. He has guided companies through every conceivable stage of their life cycle, from initial bootstrapping and market validation to Series A funding, strategic turnaround, successful exits, and even navigating the complexities of failure. Currently, Florin acts as the go-to-market strategy consultant for a UK-based family office. In this role, he works directly with technology companies in their portfolio and that are either underperforming and in need of a robust recovery plan of, or have significant potential of massive growth. His hands-on experience in launching businesses in new markets, revitalizing struggling companies, and crafting winning go-to-market strategy makes him the perfect guest to discuss the challenges and triumphs of the startup world. So, welcome, Florin, to our podcast.
Hello, Diana. Thank you for having me. It's actually a great pleasure to be with you today. And I'm actually hoping that something from that amazing introduction that you've made for me will actually help our listeners. So thank you again.
Thank you for being here, Florin. And to start, I would like to know from your extensive experience, what's the single most important lesson startups in Central and Eastern Europe must learn before going global?
That's a great question, and I'm sure that depending on who you ask, they'll give you different answers. But just in framing the conversation today, and you did mention a couple of times in the introduction that I actually act as a sales and business development consultant, and I advise family offices and companies on their go-to-market strategy. So very often, my answers today will actually come from that angle of the hands-on person that needs to make that company successful. So first and foremost, I am, and I will always be, I think, a sales person, irrespective of how I call myself for business purposes. Whether I'm a consultant or a non-executive director, I'm still a salesperson at heart. Coming back to your question, I think that the single most important lesson is actually that product market fit is not portable or not transferable. And what I mean by that is that many startups in Central and Eastern Europe, especially in the tech startup scene, they achieve amazing success locally. They become, if you will, local heroes. They build a great product, they understand the nuances of their home market, and somehow, sometimes they really end up dominating it. The mistake, though, that they usually make is that they assume that this success will automatically translate to UK, to Germany, to the US markets. And the reality is that it won't. For example, in our home markets, and it doesn't matter whether you are based in Romania, Poland, or Hungary, in our home markets, the ecosystems are usually less saturated. So a startup can win by being a good enough solution at a much lower price point, or by simply introducing a concept that's quite common in mature markets but quite novel at home. And just to give you an example, if you go back to the 2000s, I think 2005 to 2007, e-commerce was really, really new for us. online platforms that will allow you to accept and manage payments would be very, very new for the Romanian market, both for vendors but also for consumers. Whereas e-commerce has been around for many, many decades before we started talking about it in Romania. So that's why I said a little bit earlier that sometimes companies in our home markets, they become local heroes because sometimes the ecosystem is less saturated. So at the end of the day, the core value proposition for startups in our home markets often becomes price or novelty. Are we cheaper than alternatives that are available on other markets, or are we very, very new to this market, but actually this being something that's not quite new in the West, for example. So, still going back to your question, the problem is that when you take that business, any business, to a mature market like the UK or the US market, the advantage you think you have actually evaporates overnight. You essentially go from being a market leader to being just another option amongst dozens of alternatives, and likely with less brand recognition. So at the end of the day, going global isn't just a matter of translating your piece of software or your platform and a new marketing budget. It's actually a full reset. You actually have to go back to the drawing board and revalidate the problem you're solving for your new audience. In other words, is your product or the service that you are offering solving a real product, a real problem that the new market you're going into really has? And, the answer may be yes, but sometimes the customer pain point may be different, the competitive landscape may be a lot fiercer, and the buyer expectations are actually shaped and they're actually shaped by completely different influences. So what I mean by going back to the drawing board is that you need to ask that quick question of, am I still solving a problem? And if the answer is yes, that doesn't mean that you are ready to go into that market. It essentially means that you need to take a look at the problem that you are solving and see where the consumers you are selling your product and services to, they really have an appetite for what you have to offer. Keeping in mind very acutely the fact that they do not know you, and there may already be other alternatives available. So at the end of the day, the lesson that a startup can learn from this is humility. And I know it sounds weird, but you don't just export your product. You need to validate that you are solving a genuine high value problem that consumers and users are really, really ready to pay for. And remember always that your local hero status, as I said a bit earlier, actually gets you to the starting line. But in the international market expansion race, everybody starts from the same place. So humility is very, very important here, because if you're really able to understand that you are not the best who you think you are, actually doesn't make you a second runner. It actually allows you to reevaluate the entire setting with a fresh set of eyes.
Great answer, Florin. Thank you. And now we spoke about a hero, right, in a market. But let's go to the companies that are not performing so well in their own market, let's presume. So when you are stepping into an underperforming company, what are the first moves you make to design a turnaround strategy?
Interesting. First of all, the underperforming term needs to be clarified a little bit, because sometimes underperforming essentially means not delivering in line with the expectations that have been set up, I don't know, a couple of years ago. And sometimes that underperforming is related to the expectations being unrealistic. So underperforming in that context doesn't necessarily that you are in a bad situation. It simply means that we need to take a good hard look at what underperforming means and what are we benchmarking against. So that's one thing. And that's the nice scenario, let me put it that way. The not so nice scenario is one where a company is underperforming and they're running out of cash. And running out of cash essentially means that they may have, I don't know, 5, 9 months, 1 year left of runway, which essentially means how much money they have left in the bank to keep them going. So that scenario is a little bit more dramatic. And in that scenario, a sales and business consultant development, a sales and business development consultant like myself, can't be the only person that's being brought in. But still, if I am to look at this from what I'm doing at the time being, so I work with family offices. And for those in Romania or any other countries that are not familiar with family offices, these are like investment firms of rich families, if you will. And their sole purpose is actually to build and maintain what's known as generational wealth. And family offices, they have a lot of cash that they might want to invest. Sometimes they invest it in property, sometimes they invest it on the stock market, but sometimes they also invest it in startups just to diversify their portfolio further. So I'm working with a particular family office, which is based here in the UK, who has an appetite for investing in startups. And I've seen a lot of other family offices and investment firms or venture capital firms who have similar situations. What I mean by that is that they may have a portfolio of hundreds sometimes of companies that they invested in. Sometimes it's just a seed investment, which means they'll give them some money to get them started, but at the end of the day, they want to see how those companies are performing, and then they want to make a decision on whether they will invest a little bit further or a little bit more money into them. The reason why I took this rather long detour to answer your question is because underperformance, as I said a bit earlier, means different things. But then again, based on my experience with underperforming companies, normally when I'm brought in, into such a company by the family office, they call it an underperforming asset. My first move, because that was your question, is to not make a move at all. My first move is to listen, and I usually go on something that I call a listening tour with three different groups of people, and I'll talk about those in a second because the truth and the reason why the company is underperforming never sits in the boardroom. When a company is underperforming, and I know that what I'm going to say now may be a little bit controversial, but usually, from my experience, when a company is underperforming, the leadership team is often the last one to know the real reason why the company is underperforming. Sometimes, even for startups, the leadership team is insulated by layers of management. And worse of all, they sometimes, not always, they get what I call bias reports. Sometimes they look at numbers and they see the story that they want to see, not necessarily the story that they should be seeing. So that's why my first step is always to bypass the boardroom. Of course, I'll have a chat with them. I'll have a chat with the leadership. I'll take my notes. But my first step is usually to bypass the boardroom and go straight to the source of truth. So, again, coming back to your question, my first step is to listen. And I usually speak with the team on the front lines. And by that, I mean sales, customer support, developers. Sometimes even junior developers. And I ask them stuff like, what do our customers usually complain about? Why do we lose deals? What's the one thing you'd fix if you'd be the CEO for a day? And do you know what? They'll answer you, and they'll pinpoint some friction points that the leadership team may not necessarily know about. Even further, I tend to think of these frontline teams as the early warning system in a company, because they are the ones who keep on hearing stuff like, oh, your price is too high. Your competitors have these amazing game-changing features that you don't have, and they tend to hear it 10, 20, 50 times a day. And often they tend to have brilliant, simple solutions to fix the problems that they are seeing. Just to give you an example, in one turnaround instance I was involved, the support team told me that their response time to client queries was slowed down because they were using three disparate systems, and they had to search for something here, something there, and so on. When I spoke with the leadership team, well, those guys, they were in the middle of investing close to $1 million into an AI powered system that did something out of the ordinary, which, okay, maybe would have been a good solution, but for the particular problem that the frontline teams were describing me, a simple integration of those three different systems was the answer to their product, to their problems. So that's an example of where or why I speak to the front lines. And I know this is just an isolated example, but there are so many other situations where the leadership team thinks about the latest technology, the most game-changing tools and solutions, whereas sometimes the answer can be as simple as maybe reorganizing some teams, integrating systems, relooking at the processes and so on. So speaking with the frontline teams is really important for me. Then again, speaking to customers who have recently churned, as we say in software, customers who have canceled their subscriptions or who have stopped being a customer altogether. The reason why it's invaluable to be speaking with them is because they have no reasons to be polite. And they will give you the unvarnished truth. And I know that sometimes you'll have to deal with angry customers or former customers, and sometimes, you know, their reasons for canceling are not necessarily related to your product or service. And sometimes the answers you may get, they might not match. But what I'm generally looking for here is a pattern. A pattern meaning if they talk about how they've been treated by the customer support team, if there's a pattern in how they describe their interaction with the development team or with the sales team or with the management team, those are the things you need to be mindful of. And again, moving forward, obviously you want to speak with your most loyal customers. And this is something that a lot of startups, they overlook, or if they do, they do it they don't do it with a critical mind, with a critical eye, because sometimes they go to a customer, you know, they sit down, they have a nice chat, but they forget to ask questions such as, you know, why did you buy from us in the first place? When you bought, what piqued your attention? And more importantly, are you getting what you're paying for? And are we delivering on our promises? So these are questions that should be asked. And again, coming back to your question, as I said, I normally go in the on this listening tour, and I speak with the customers, existing customers, past customers, and with the front and customer facing teams, because that's where the answers are. And then again, once you had the chance to speak with all of these guys, then you can accurately diagnose the problem, and then you can make some decisions on what would be the next steps. But again, you know, sometimes it's about streamlining processes and operations. Sometimes it's about reorganizing teams. Sometimes it's about doing a better job on taking feedback on board. And at the end of the day, the key question that companies need to ask themselves when they think their business is underperforming is, why are we really underperforming? Are we somehow missing to deliver the value we are selling, or is there another reason? And you actually start from there. But that's how I generally go about it. And again, we can go into a lot more details about it, but that's the starting point. go on a listening tour, and I feel like a rock star sometimes when I go on that listening tour. Wait.
That's a very good strategy, and I must confess that being a business consultant myself and specialized in business optimization, I actually resonate with completely with what you said, because the problem never stays in the boarding room, so and the solutions either. So it's better to go and talk to people that are working directly and understand what's going wrong there, what would they do, as you said before, if they had the chance to be the CEO of the company for one day, what essential or fundamental things they would change. So excellent. Thank you, Florin, for this answer. Now, you spoke about investors before. Family businesses interested in investing in different startups. Now, let's look at these people beyond the numbers on a pitch deck. What would you consider to be the most important ingredient a business must have that truly makes these investors say, okay, yes, I will invest in your startup?
A good one. By the way, so the way a lot of investment firms work, whether it's a family office or a VC or private investors, they will always have somebody to filter the decks you send them. And yes, of course, those analysts, they will take a look at the numbers, they will try to make sense of it. But at the end of the day, the reason why investors want to meet you is because they want to get to know you, the person who's putting that story in front of them. You see, every investor actually sees hundreds of decks, and those decks are usually filled with tons of buzzwords. Whatever the buzzword of the day is, you'll find it there. These days, it's all about AI. AI powered this, AI backed that, agentic this, agentic that. Look, don't get me wrong. There's nothing wrong with buzzwords, because it shows that you understand the market and you understand the trends. But really, what cuts through the noise, I'd say, is what I would call a palpable, almost irrational obsession the founder has with the problem they are solving. So you see, I call this the founder problem fit. We talk about the product market fit and all that, but this is a founder problem fit. How do I describe this? A founder with a founder solution fit, just to contrast that, is usually in love with their clever algorithm, their beautiful app, or their groundbreaking technology. It's that. When a customer, for example, gives them a negative feedback, they get defensive. They tend to say, "Oh yes, but the customer doesn't just get it." This type of founder is a huge, huge risk for an investor, because they are uncoachable, and more importantly, their ego is tied to their first idea, and they believe that their first idea is the right one. So that's the founder solution fit. Coming back to my founder problem fit, this individual is different, because their ego is not tied to the solution, it's tied to solving a problem. You'll recognize these people because they'll talk endlessly about their customers and not their code. They'll talk about how they can make the life easier for the other person. In some way, is almost an altruistic attitude. I'm doing this for the other. I'm doing this to help that other person solve a problem. And sometimes they see their product not as an attempt or a one-time experiment. They see it as a journey to helping the end customer solve the problem to or a journey to find the customer, finding the best solution. And thinking back to how these people react to when they get negative feedback, they will never say, "Oh, you don't get it." They will actually lean in with genuine curiosity, and they'll say stuff like, "I don't know, interesting. Tell me more. Why didn't that work for you?" And that's what I call the founder problem fit, and that's why I think it's different. So at the end of the day, this founder, as I said, is relentless, almost obsessive, connecting the product to the problem they are solving, and for them is not really being in love with their product or with the technology or with the service that they are offering. It's about being in love with their customer and their customer's pain. And please don't get me wrong, that doesn't mean they can't be in love with their product and service. That's important to them. But they focus first and foremost on the client and their problem, as I said a couple of times already. And more importantly, these are the individuals who are coachable. We can see the alternative to the reality they may have created for themselves. And more importantly, they can turn around. They can essentially say, "Okay, what got me here won't get me there. So who can help me get to the place where I want to be?" But again, this comes from being an individual that's always open, that's not necessarily in love with their product or platform, but who is genuinely connected to the problem they're trying to solve. And again, coming back to your question, that's what investors want to see. Of course, they want to see a good business case, and solid numbers, a total addressable market, the ability to actually deliver on that. That's important as well. But at the end of the day, everything being equal, when you are presented with two or three companies that have the potential, have the market, and so on, the investor will choose the right individual. And here in the UK, they use this analogy that investors are betting on the jockey, not just the horse. So the founder problem fit is the sign of a jockey who will find a way to win no matter what the market context and situation will be.
Is this linked to the leadership profile that you have in that company? And I'm asking you this because I would like to know your perception about what are the leadership qualities that separate founders who survive from those who scale and thrive internationally.
Another loaded question. I think the key quality that separates the survivor type of leader is the ability to actually making the transition to evolve from being a founder to being a CEO. And sometimes the transition from a domestic startup founder to a global CEO is one of the hardest leadership journeys to make for any individual. The skills that made you successful initially, being the best salesperson, knowing your product inside out, knowing every line of code you have written, maybe. Ironically, those are the exact skills that will hold you back at the international stage. So the survivor founder tries, if you will, to clone themselves. For example, they try to run the German office from Bucharest. They insist on approving every marketing email, every sales discount, and they want to interview everybody you want to hire, whether it's in your local market or in the international market. And what happens there is that they become a micromanager, and funny enough, they become the bottleneck. They can't really scale beyond their personal capacity to control things. And in a way, this leads to frustrated local teams, slow decision making, and a failure to eventually adapt to new market conditions. Funny, I once saw a founder who burned through three French country managers in just 18 months because he kept on overriding every single decision those guys were making about local pricing, partnerships, marketing approach, and so on. This particular individual, he actually thought that what worked in Poland will actually work globally. So he survived. That's why I called them the survivor CEO, but the French business never took off. They continued to survive in their local market, but they were never really able to make the transition to the international market. As opposed to the survivor CEO or founder is what I call the thriver founder. And this one, I think this individual masters what I think we could call delegating trust. Because at the end of the day, this is different from delegating tasks. So, for example, it's about hiring an expert for a new market and trusting them to be the CEO of that region. It means setting clear goals, the what, if you will, but giving people in the region the autonomy to decide on the how. A founder I'm working with right now, and they are based in Poland, he actually hired a new UK general manager, and he said to this new UK gen UK manager general manager, he said to her, the target is $2 million, okay, revenue. This is your budget. My job is actually to provide air cover, resources, strategic guidance, if you will, and your job is to make it happen. Because you know the market, the UK market, better than I ever will. And kind of rounding up and going back to your question, I think that at the end of the day, you need to move from being a controller to being an enabler, from being a doer, I'm going to do everything by myself, to being a leader of others. And in my opinion, this is the biggest factor that determines whether a startup survives the international expansion, or whether they will just thrive. Okay. And we all want these companies to thrive. But, based on everything I said, at the end of the day, yes, in terms of qualities, yes, you need to have a certain level of business acumen. Yes, you have to have a certain level of intelligence, let me put it that way. But it all comes down to how you are as a human being. Are you a a person that trusts other, or are you a person that actually doubts the other? Do you think there are smarter people out there than you are, or do you think you are the only one who can do it? And I know that somehow this sounds like the stuff you read in the books, but that's what happens. So if you really, really want to grow your business, whether it's international or even locally, you need to think as an enabler rather than a doer. And that, as a human being, that takes you on a personal development journey that can't be helped by business advisors. Sometimes can be helped by coaches, life coaches, therapists if you need, good partners that you can speak with. So yeah, that's how I see the leadership qualities that some people need to have.
I like your answer because in the end it's about your inner person or
Yeah.
personal space or your inner world. How do you position yourself out there as a human being and then as a business owner, right?
In a way, it's just like going from teenage years, going to early youth, and then growing through life again. But I can't stress enough how important it is to be able to connect with yourself. And that's why sometimes I tell a lot of the people I work with, disconnect, throw your phone, uninstall your email application. I know it sounds drastic, but you need mind space in order to actually understand what's missing. And more importantly, you need to be honest with yourself. But you're right, Diana. That's how it happens.
And this brings me to the last question. If you could give one mindset shift, because we spoke about mindset, right?
Yeah.
Every entrepreneur listening right now, what do you think would help them to build a business that lasts?
Look, I want to go back to what I know best, which is go to market. And go to market is all about a product or a service that you are selling to consumers, whether consumers are B2C consumers or B2B, doesn't even matter. The important thing to bear in mind is that we all sell something, and that something solves a problem. If it doesn't solve a problem, or if you think it doesn't solve a problem, you have a problem. And to your question, I think the biggest quality is to fall in love, with the problem, not with the product or service you're selling. And we've already talked about this, but essentially, what I've seen over the years, both as an employee in companies that have scaled globally, but also working with startups from various industries and verticals, is that your product will evolve. That's a given. If you think that the product you have today is going to be the same with the product you're going to have in 5 years' time or 10 years' time, you're absolutely wrong and you shouldn't be doing this type of work. Fall in love with the problem your product or products or services are solving, and not with a product. And again, going back to some of the points I've made earlier, when you fall in love with your product, the beautiful code, the clever feature, the nice app, and so on, you are essentially doing business. You're actually showing to the world your ego. And people don't like egos. At the end of the day, we'll all have to remember that people buy people, and people connect to genuine people. And being a genuine person, at the end of the day, it's all about being able to listen, but not listen so you can get in and say whatever you wanted, but listen so you can understand why that person is saying that thing. So the ego gets in the way. And when the ego gets in the way, it's very difficult for the founders to pivot and to adopt new ideas or to seek help that at the end of the day can solve can save their company. To contrast that, founders who are in love with a problem, they see feedback they get from the market as a gift, and that every single feedback they get gets them closer to the right solution. So again, I think the most important thing here is to fall in love with the problem and try and not the product. And at the end of the day, try to set your ego aside and try to listen to other people around you, or even people who don't necessarily have anything to do with your business. And always remember that your solution, or the way you are solving the problem today, is temporary and will evolve. And funny enough, I keep on saying this to some of the people I work with, your job as a CEO isn't to protect your idea. It's actually to relentlessly, if you will, pursue the best possible answer to your customer's problem. So that's why paying attention to the problem and not to the product is more important than the product itself. Of course, there comes a moment when the product needs to match the problem and how people want those problems to be solved, but that's a completely different conversation.
Excellent. Thank you so much, Florin, for sharing your wisdom and your experiences today with all of us. And this brings us to the end of an insightful and thought-provoking conversation where Florin reminded us that startups are not just about ideas, but about execution, resilience, and the courage to adapt. That scaling globally isn't about luck, but about strategy, timing, and the right partnership and the right people behind. And that even failure can be a stepping stone if we choose to learn and rebuild with clarity. So, if you're ready to strengthen your go-to-market strategies, as Florin said before, navigate challenges with more confidence and unlock new growth opportunities for your business, take these insights and start putting them into practice today. Don't miss the chance to explore the mentoring opportunities available in our community by checking the links below. The right guidance could be the catalyst of your next breakthrough. And if you found value in this episode, share it with your colleagues or friends who could benefit. And don't forget to subscribe to our channels so you never miss a conversation that could change your business journey. So thank you for tuning in. And until next time, remember, building businesses that last is not just about profit, it's about purpose, people, and perseverance. Thank you, Florin.
Thank you so much. Till next time, take care.